Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
We have got a cast iron assurance and a guarantee from the British government.
The particular problems around the Irish border are being used politically to try to frustrate Brexit.
Northern Ireland must leave the European Union on the same terms as the rest of the United Kingdom.
Northern Ireland would form part of our customs territory.
Hello and welcome to Brexit Republic, RTE's podcast on Brexit. I'm Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor in Brussels.
And I'm Emer Lowe, RTE's foreign editor in Dublin, standing in for Colm O'Mungon. Each week, Brexit Republic assesses the latest negotiations in Brussels and the latest politics in Dublin and London.
We thought last week was hard to beat with two big beast resignations in David Davis and Boris Johnson, as well as the publication of the Chequers White Paper.
But already this week we've had carnage in the Tory party with further resignations, Theresa May clinging to power, the Chequers White Paper being torn to shreds by Brexit hardliners, and key amendments to bills in the House of Commons, which according to some will kill off the White Paper altogether.
And that has darkened the mood considerably in Dublin and Brussels, because all of this chaos is surely increasing the risk of a no-deal scenario and the UK potentially crashing out next March.
We'll try to assess that risk and what all this means for the Irish backstop. We'll hear later from the head of the Freight Transport Association Ireland on how those frontline exporters and logistics companies will cope. And we'll also hear from the heart of the pro-Brexit camp on another dizzying week at Westminster. But first, Tony, can you remind us of what's in the White Paper and why exactly Brexiteers find it so offensive?
Well, Emer, the White Paper is a big document. It's 98 pages long, and it was really the set piece British government vision of the future beyond Brexit. What will the relationship between the UK and the EU look like across a range of issues? Now, it deals with economics and trade, but also security, data protection, the whole spectrum of how both sides of the continental divide, if you like, will relate to each other beyond Brexit. And it was a very, very difficult journey for Theresa May to get there, because clearly the White Paper points to a much softer Brexit than her Lancaster House speech last year, and what clearly a lot of people in her parties believed was a more clean-cut Brexit. Essentially, the White Paper tries to square the circle of Britain leaving the European Union, but keeping frictionless trade with the EU, and in particular, avoiding any need for checks and infrastructure on the Irish border. Another key element of it is to ensure that businesses are not facing huge disruption, that very, very complex and valuable supply chains that snake from the UK across the EU are not disrupted. So what she ended up with this white paper was something that was quite acrobatic, if you like, in trying to make all these things work together in a way in which she would be able to bring her party with her. So it talks about a single rule book that the EU, or a common rule book that the UK and EU would follow, but essentially it would be the EU single market rules. It talked about a customs partnership idea that would kind of keep the UK in the EU customs territory, but then wouldn't really. So there was so much ambiguity in there. But I think the problem first up was that once this white paper was published, you had David Davis resigning, then Boris Johnson resigning. And once Conservatives began to go through it in detail, they could see that it didn't liberate the UK from the EU at all. In fact, it kept the UK very, very closely aligned with the EU's structure, the EU's regulatory orbit, and customs. Now, I think a very important thing to say about the white paper is that it deals with the future relationship. So it's not something that has to be agreed by October. We think of October as a very important deadline for Brexit, but that is the divorce agreement, the withdrawal agreement that has to be done by October, perhaps November. I think the virtue from Theresa May's point of view of the white paper was that it could be negotiated over a longer period of time during the transition, and the transition is 2 years long. And so, I think that's why we saw a fairly muted, polite reaction from the EU when the white paper was published, because it was seen as a good start. It was welcome that at least there was a detailed paper on the table. And of course, there was time to actually sit down and go through this.
So, Tony, where is the white paper now? It's been a really fraught week, as you mentioned, in Westminster. Chequers seems to be, well, where is Chequers and what of this white paper? I mean, what's your reading of the situation as things stand right now?
Well, politically, the white paper has suffered tremendous slings and arrows since it was published. You had those two high-profile resignations, David Davis and Boris Johnson. Steve Baker, also Theresa May's Brexit minister, resigned. And he, in particular, has been organising something of a party within a party. He's got this WhatsApp group of Tory MPs who have antipathy towards the white paper, and he's trying to coordinate how they vote in key amendments. Talking of amendments, of course, then this week we had a situation where there were four amendments put forward by the European Research Group led by Jacob Rees-Mogg. That's, of course, the Eurosceptic group within the Tory party. On Monday, and those amendments were to deal with the trade bill, which is very much linked to what kind of relationship the UK will have with the EU after Brexit. And two of those amendments in particular seemed to kill off the white paper, if you like. First of all, it said that the UK could not enter a customs partnership with the EU whereby it collected EU tariffs if the EU weren't going to do the same. Now, the white paper expressly said that the UK wouldn't ask the EU to do that. And then more specifically, from an Irish point of view, one of the amendments said that in the event of Brexit, Northern Ireland cannot be treated any differently from the rest of the UK when it comes to customs. Now, obviously, that is the core element of the Irish backstop, that if nothing else works, then Northern Ireland would remain aligned with the single market and the customs union to avoid a hard border. So these amendments were fairly momentous and have cast real doubt on whether the white paper can survive, and also whether the backstop can survive. We can bring in Hugh Bennett now, I think, at this point. Hugh is from Brexit Central. That is a pro-leave organisation in the UK. We can welcome Hugh now. Welcome to Brexit Republic.
Hi there.
Can you just tell people, first of all, what Brexit Central is all about?
So we're an online news and analysis website, sort of a one-stop shop for Brexit, basically. So it's a mixture of, I think we compile the news every morning, put it out in a morning bulletin so everyone knows what's going on with Brexit. And then we have a lot of analysis pieces, reaction pieces, comment pieces from MPs, business people, economists, all sorts of people involved in the Brexit debate. So just sort of trying to give people, keep people as informed as possible.
Hugh, what exactly is going on with Brexit after this week?
Well, I think when you look at the actual amendments that have been accepted by the government, I'm not convinced that they do really change the substance of the Brexit white paper. I think, as you said, it changes the Irish backstop, but that's sort of in the UK government's position already. So it just codifies that they don't want to accept Northern Ireland becoming a separate customs territory. As for the rest of them, I think, you know, there's frankly a lot of people that are very sceptical about whether this customs partnership type idea is going to work anyway. So I think, you know, my reading of it probably just turns it from being very, very unlikely to be agreed to very, very, very unlikely. Looking at it, I think the sort of pessimistic view, I think, is probably that whatever the UK ends up in will end up looking very much like a customs union at the end of the day with the EU. So in that sense, I think the white paper is sort of still on track. It's taken a lot of heavy fire, it's taken a lot of heavy criticism, and I think Downing Street, I think Theresa May has been really quite taken aback by the strength of feeling, particularly amongst grassroots Tory supporters. But there aren't any indications that she's actually going to consider changing her plan altogether. I think Boris Johnson gave his resignation statement saying it's not too late to save Brexit. We need to go back to the Lancaster House vision, not Chequers, which I think he described as a sort of miserable permanent limbo. But the signs from the government so far are that they're going to stick with Chequers, and I think this week doesn't necessarily change that.
I think that's a very good reading, Hugh. One way of looking at this from an Irish point of view is that you have a lot of this noise and sideshow, if you like. Maybe that's not strong enough a word for it. But anyway, all the stuff that's happening in Westminster is one thing, but on the other hand, you have a set of negotiations in Brussels between the European Union and an exiting member state, and that's really what counts. And there's a view in Dublin, I think, that ultimately when we get into the autumn and Theresa May has to agree a withdrawal agreement with the EU, then these amendments can be revisited, they can be de-amended, if you like. And it's often the case that when a country enters an international legally binding treaty, it often has to change domestic legislation anyway. So there is a view in Dublin, I think, that this is not necessarily a terminal for the white paper and terminal for the backstop, even though the European Research Group amendment specifically, I think, sends a spear to the heart of the backstop, because it says there's no way that there can be any difference between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom. I mean, it's important to point out that the Irish government and the EU are saying we don't want there to be any difference, but the backstop is there as a guarantee if there's nothing else around that fixes the Irish border problem.
And I think actually when you look at the Chequers plan, I think it's like the UK's version of the backstop, how they interpreted the backstop, fleshed out in full. So if the EU said, we're prepared to basically, you know, waive all our rules, waive all our dogma about the indivisibility of the single market, and we will actually allow Northern Ireland alone to basically cherry-pick parts of the single market as well as staying in the customs territory. And I think the EU's been interpreting that as that offer as only applying to Northern Ireland. The Chequers plan is almost basically just trying to apply that to the whole UK. It's applying a common rule book in a limited number of areas, probably only a few chapters of the Acquis rather than all of them. And it's basically maintaining a customs territory that is in effect a customs union. So I think Theresa May, with this Chequers plan, I think her idea is that this sort of would negate the need for the EU's version of the backstop, because this is the UK's version of the backstop. But of course, the bigger problem is that if the EU doesn't accept this, and I think the signs are that they will certainly push for many more concessions, I think Barnier's end position is going to be that the UK has to remain fully inside the single market and the customs union, the sort of Norway plus model. So I think now that the sort of Northern Ireland specific backstop has been ruled out, I think, you know, that the EU might start laying the groundwork for pushing the UK towards a full single market and customs union endpoint.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to remind listeners that, you know, there are two stages here. There's the withdrawal agreement, which has to be agreed by October, November, and then there's the future relationship. The two are obviously interlinked in a very intimate way, and in fact, it's the Irish border which is the bridge between the two, in effect. I mean, my understanding of where this is sort of aiming is that the Irish government and the EU are insisting, and I suppose will insist, that the backstop has to be in there as a legally operable entity within the withdrawal agreement in this so-called protocol. The British preference, of course, is that backstop is taken out of the withdrawal agreement, and instead in goes the British plan, which is this temporary customs arrangement which was proposed by Theresa May at the beginning of June. And this would see a temporary situation where Britain stays effectively in the customs union for a couple of years till the end of the transition, and then the new arrangement kind of kicks in. So that you wouldn't need to have an Irish backstop. And of course, that's not going to be acceptable to Dublin or Brussels, because they insist that the backstop has to be in there. So the way that officials in Brussels that I speak to see the white paper is that they see it, at least even if it's flawed, they see it as some cotton wool, if you like, or some way that the backstop, which is problematic, can be enveloped by strong signposting that in the future the UK will be very, very close to the EU anyway. And so that makes the backstop less toxic to unionists and to conservatives. But the trouble is, as I see it, if these amendments are undermining the white paper and Theresa May's position, it makes that political dynamic a lot more difficult. I suppose the question now is where do we go from here after the summer? I mean, obviously the negotiations will continue in Brussels. Both Dublin and Brussels believe that the Irish backstop still has to be negotiated and worked on and worked out, I guess, by the autumn. But obviously, if the withdrawal agreement is reached in October, then it has to go back to the House of Commons. And the question then is, what would the posture of the European Research Group and Jacob Rees-Mogg be? Would they still try to vote the withdrawal agreement down and in so doing threaten a no-deal scenario and also bring back into prominence this idea of a second referendum?
That notion of a no-deal, I mean, I know it's always been lurking there in the background, kind of menacing, but we're just hearing more and more about it. And this week it seemed to kind of move more into the foreground. Hugh, I mean, again, in Westminster, is that really no-deal, that's a serious scenario, or is it just kind of a threat?
I think probably the feeling amongst Brexiteers is that May is, you know, for all her rhetoric about saying no deal is better than a bad deal, that she, you know, she wants to avoid no deal at any cost. And I think there's a significant element of the Commission's thinking where they really don't want to have no deal either. And I think this has sort of led to differing interpretations of what would happen if the withdrawal agreement was voted down. I think on the one hand, you've got Brexiteers who think, if we vote the withdrawal agreement down, then we'll go to a no-deal outcome, all our problems are solved, happy days. On the other hand, you've got the sort of hard Remainers who want to try and force a second referendum. And I think they think that if the withdrawal agreement was voted down, somehow in the ensuing chaos, whatever, May would probably try and postpone Article 50 to negotiate a further deal, and that would open the door to a second referendum somehow. In the chaos. So I think, you know, both sides sort of seem to be taking a different view of what would happen in that scenario. Trying to predict how people would vote this far out is very, very difficult, I think. I think for sure.
I mean, do you detect, Hugh, sorry to interrupt, do you detect a change in the sort of the molecular atmosphere in the UK regarding a second referendum? And, you know, especially since we've had business taking a much more overt stance on Brexit and the potential damage that it would do?
Well, it's a bit funny because I think business has sort of got more or less everything they wanted for in terms of, you know, the headline rhetoric hasn't changed. May still says we're leaving the single market and the customs union, but you know, her Chequers plan essentially recreates all of the substantial elements of them. So they're basically getting what they want if May manages to get the Chequers plan through. I think there's a bit of noise about it, but I think there was a vote on it in the House of Commons just recently. I think the Lib Dems put another amendment forwards. It got very little support, I think about 20 or 30 votes. I just don't think there's ever going to be a parliamentary majority for a second referendum, whatever happens. I know the Conservatives are never going to support it, more than about three or four backbenchers, and I think the vast majority of the Labour Party wouldn't support it either. So I don't think a second referendum is likely to happen.
So that was Hugh Bennett of Brexit Central joining us there on Brexit Republic. Tony, as we heard during the conversation with Hugh, the no-deal spectre is looming, and certainly the Minister for Foreign Affairs and Taoiseach Simon Coveney has said that Ireland is preparing for a no-deal scenario. In fact, Theresa May is also saying that Europe should take note that the UK is preparing for a no-deal scenario. But what exactly is this going to mean for Irish interests?
Yeah, well, the no-deal scenario, Eimear, is much more clear and present danger now. You know, as we've been discussing, there is all this chaos in Westminster. There doesn't seem to be a parliamentary majority for any of the options going forward on Brexit. And one risk is either that there is a move against Theresa May's leadership, a possible general election that throws the timetable completely off course, and that the Brexit Article 50 negotiations simply run out of time, and then you'd have the UK crashing out in March of next year. The European Commission is getting more and more worried about a no-deal situation. They have issued a very strongly worded letter to all member states and all EU institutions, communication that RTE broke the news of last week, which basically warned of a no-deal situation, warned that member states themselves have to do a lot of the preparatory work on this across the board, things like financial services, customs, data protection, aviation, pharmaceuticals, a whole range of things that would be adversely affected if there is a no deal. I think the Irish government is in a pretty difficult political situation in terms of how it signals the way it is working towards a no deal situation, because of course they can't say that they're making any contingency plans for the Irish border, because the government works on the assumption that a hard border in Ireland will not be permitted in any circumstances. So they are instead talking about preparations at ports and other locations in terms of how to mitigate the effect of a hard crash out next March. One of the interesting elements, I think, that is worrying the government is the question of the UK as a land bridge. A lot of the products we send to Europe go through the UK by freight and then by ferry on to mainland Europe. And the question is, in the future, post-Brexit, what happens to those goods as they're transported through the land bridge of the UK? Because they would essentially be going from one member state of the EU to another, but using the land bridge of a third country. So does that mean Irish trucks would have checks when they come into Wales or Liverpool or wherever? Or and in turn, would there be a case where Irish trucks are having to join a huge tailback in Dover, or would they be given a fast track, a priority boarding, if you like, to get on ferries ahead of British trucks and then be given preferential treatment when they get to the other end, whether it's Zeebrugge or Rotterdam? These are very, very complicated and politically difficult issues for the Irish government. Now, the UK has promised to join the common transit area, which would make life a lot easier. But the Irish government is having to negotiate with both the European Commission and other member states like Belgium and the Netherlands and France so that they can facilitate the reception of Irish trucks in a different manner from British trucks as they come in to the mainland of Europe. So that's a pretty difficult scenario. To get a general picture of how the freight and logistics community are preparing for this and all of the chaos and instability and fragility that we're seeing at the moment, I've been speaking to Aidan Flynn, who's General Manager of Freight Transport Association Ireland, and here's what he's been telling me about the sector.
Aidan Flynn, welcome to Brexit Republic. Just tell us exactly what your organisation does, first of all.
Thanks, Tony. FTA Ireland are a multimodal representative trade association that represents commercial fleet operators in both the haulage and the own account sector, as well as coach and bus and van fleet operators, freight forwarders and the like.
So I would say at a glance, your organisation, your members are pretty affected by Brexit, pretty worried about what's going to happen. I mean, just describe to us what happens at the moment. Britain is in the EU, it's in the customs union, it's in the single market. How does that govern the way freight and haulage and operators move from Ireland to the UK and back again?
Well, road freight distribution is very liberalised because of the UK's membership of the EU, of the single market and of the customs union. And effectively what that means is that goods can move freely, frictionlessly between all EU member states.
So there's no paperwork as such, no customs checks, you roll on and you roll off at the other end?
Look, effectively, it's limited. There is manifests. There is a little bit of paperwork, obviously, determining the goods and the vehicles and so on. But it is limited. And that enables the driver and truck to be able to move from Dublin Port to Holyhead, disembark and go about its way seamlessly, as it does allow trucks to travel throughout continental Europe seamlessly as well.
Now, of course, one of the big problems for Irish exports is that 80% or so of our exports that go to the European Union go through the land bridge, as we call it, of the UK. So trucks bring goods from Dublin to Holyhead, say, then those goods move across the UK to ports where they are then ferried further on to the European continent. What are the immediate challenges there? Because obviously once Britain is out of the European Union, that disrupts that entire flow.
Well, the challenge is delays, right? So Dover Port have publicly advised that even a 2-minute delay to processing a vehicle will result in 27-kilometre tailbacks. They say that it currently takes approximately 2 minutes to process a truck. So you're going from 2 minutes to 4 minutes, and you're looking at the consequences of 27-kilometre tailbacks, which has dire consequences in relation to the supply chain, the just-in-time distribution model of logistics, and that is at stake in relation to getting your products. There is very little alternative for Irish business, and it's not just about exports, it's about imports, it's about accessibility. So if the land bridge becomes longer in terms of delays, of course there can be perhaps a number of hours built in, which does have cost implications for the haulage sector and everything else, but they may be bearable perhaps. But the alternative, there is very little alternative. It's, you know, 18 hours via land bridge versus 38 hours direct from, say, Dublin to Zeebrugge. It's a no-brainer. That land bridge is vitally important for jobs, for the haulage sector, for roll-on, roll-off model of distribution, and in particular for the food, agri-food sector, where everything is time-sensitive.
Now, there's been a lot of talk this week of a no-deal scenario, given the extremely volatile situation in Westminster and the ever-narrowing range of options for Theresa May. How well prepared do you think Irish ports are for a no-deal scenario, and the Irish system is for a no-deal scenario?
There's serious concerns, growing concerns certainly within our association, that we are facing a no deal. I think preparedness in general, it's vitally important now, whether people don't want to countenance a doomsday no deal scenario. I think it is becoming increasingly likely, but likely in the sense that all businesses should have their contingencies in place, and by that the advice we're giving to our members is to review and look at their current practices, their current contracts, where they're getting goods into and where they're taking them from, talk to their customers and clients, link in with the supply chain, and definitely start talking with the likes of ports, all ports, and ports perhaps that they're not using in terms of their import-export activity, to look at what viable solutions there are, what they are actually doing in terms of focusing on their own preparedness for this type of scenario.
Can you just spell out to people what the difference will be from one day to the next? One day up until the end of March next year, Britain will still be in the European Union. If there's no deal, then there's no transition. What will happen the next day, the first day of Brexit, a disorderly Brexit? What are the implications for a truck driver leaving Dublin, heading to the UK?
Well, unfortunately, the implications are shutters down. There is no legal basis to move goods from one country, from Ireland into the UK, nor from the UK into Ireland. When we're looking at single market issues, for instance, that looks at mutual recognition. So we're talking even as basic as driver licensing. Are you allowed to drive that vehicle on the roads of the UK? And not as much of an issue, because most of the imports coming from the UK into Ireland are coming from Irish operators, but it would be the same reciprocal basis. Can a UK driver, an operator, operate in the EU? And the answer is no. Like, unless there is mutual recognition, unless there is agreements in relation to all of that type of stuff. Customs issues are perhaps resolvable easier in terms of there is a tariff, there is a rate on it, you know, that's what it is, and so on. The single market issue is quite more of a bigger problem, and all you have to do is even look at the agri-food sector, where you're looking at sanitary, phytosanitary issues, Dublin Port, Dublin Airport.
So for food, that is basically do the food products and the animal products that you're carrying, do they comply with EU food health and safety regulations?
Yeah, Exactly. And they all have to be agreed. And the agreement in relation to that just doesn't happen overnight. And the other fear we would have, going back a step perhaps, even if there is a transition period, will it be more of the same, what we're used to now? Will there be any certainty? Will there be any end game where businesses can start preparing to? And I have to say, at the moment, it's nearly in the same bracket as no deal, because even if we get to a transition, I think we will be into a number of years of uncertainty where perhaps this time next year, or indeed in July 2020, we still don't know what the final outcome is going to be. And businesses really do require certainty in relation to being able to prepare for the outcome. So the scenarios are quite frightening, but becoming ever more real.
And that was Aidan Flynn of the Freight Transport Association of Ireland there speaking to Tony earlier. Well, look, I think one thing we can all take away from Brexit is that there's never a dull moment. And in fact, this podcast has been recorded before Theresa May makes her first visit to the Irish border. So no doubt we'll be hearing more of that and reading more about that in the days ahead. And you can check it out on RTE. That's all from me, Eimear Lowe, here in Dublin, standing in for Colm O'Mungon. He'll be back in August.
Thanks, Eimear. And it's all from me, Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor in Brussels. We'll be looking out, obviously, for what happens in the next coming weeks. There will be further negotiations in Brussels between British and EU negotiators on the Irish backstop issue. And you can catch up with my latest analysis on the RTE website. My Brexit blog will be out again on Saturday. And we'll be back here in the middle of August for the next episode of Brexit Republic. Thanks for listening.